now. And then lastly, if you want to ask a question and you want to use the, and you want to ask a question, say your name and where you're from. And you're welcome to also chat comments or chat questions in the box at the bottom of your screen. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce first Jane Arthur and then Jody Fried. Jane, take it away.
Thanks, Suzanne. Can everybody hear me? Mm-hmm. I'll just look for nods. Yeah, great. I'm having some trouble for some reason with my computer hearing everybody very well. So if you could just speak up when you, if you have a question or a comment, it really helped me. I don't know what's wrong with my computer, but I can't get it to turn up. So it was great when Suzanne asked if I would join this Chewing on Leadership, because I have to say, I'd say a good chunk of my time is spent in difficult conversations. I know some of you. I used to run Karma Choling, the Buddhist Retreat Center in Barnet, and now I oversee all of our Shambhala centers worldwide, which is about 200 centers. So most of my work is working with leaders. And of course, I had the delightful duty of being the director of BLI for 2 years. I see a couple of people, or two or three people, from those years. So I would say 90% of my work is people, and 80% is difficult conversation. So that gives some sense of where I live my life. And I thought I would just talk a little bit about what I'm working with a lot right now, which I think is a common theme for many of us as our world has begun to polarize more and more, and there seems to be people are pretty solid in their positions about things, but also people are feeling emboldened and empowered. So there's sort of both going on, which is an interesting juxtaposition, that while we're polarizing more, people are also feeling like they can speak up. And so my personal experiences of a lot of people wanting to speak up about things that they've been holding for a very long time. So what I thought I would share is more of a personal kind of difficult conversation. There are, of course, positional policy difficult conversations, but I thought I'd speak more to a personal difficult conversation that's maybe emblematic of the kinds of conversations that are going around for lots of people right now. And this has to do with the Me Too movement. And I think I've made a lot of assumptions, being a woman, that I wouldn't have to deal with those conversations in quite the same way perhaps men might be having to deal with the conversations. But recently I had a woman contact me and express that I had actually harmed her. And during my time being the director of Karma Choling, that I had had to ask her to leave Karma Choling. And that was quite a while ago. And she contacted me over the years, and I chose not to reconnect with her. And then recently, because of the Me Too movement, I think her voice was going to be heard in a new way. And so she contacted me, and I kind of put her off for a while, and because frankly it was, her energy was so intense that it was really, I didn't know that I was up to handling her energy. And I don't know if anyone else might have had that experience, where you've wanted to speak with someone and they're quite their energy is really up. They're angry, or they're frustrated, or they're irritated to the point that it's hard to imagine actually having a productive conversation. But I agreed finally to do that, and asked her to, ahead of time, write her whole, what she was upset with me about. And it turned out, again, it was so interesting to me. She said that part of the harm was that I was a misogynist. So that might surprise some of you, being a woman, that a woman could be a misogynist or could be called a misogynist. And I was shocked, needless to say, and I was glad that I had asked her to write it out for me ahead of time so that I had time. I think that's one of the principles, like if it's really going to be that difficult of a conversation, it's good to know what you're dealing with ahead of time if someone's willing to write to you. So she did, and so I had time to really take this to heart and really try to read between the lines and really try to understand what it was saying to me. And what she was saying was that I was complicit in a system in which women's voices were not taken as seriously as men's voices. And she had felt that I had kind of taken the side of some men in the conversation and believed them more than I believed her. And I had to really take a hard look at that. So I also agreed to speak with her as long as we had a third party there. And again, another principle, if you think it's going to be really hot and you both have motivation to have a productive conversation, then it's often really helpful to have somebody, not as a mediator particularly, but somebody who holds the space, which I find personally what happens is I'm on my best behavior so that it doesn't kind of digress into a really unhelpful conversation. So we had a person that we both trusted to really just listen. And that's basically all she did. She didn't interject much. It was mostly listening. And I guess I want Jody to have plenty of time and lots of time for questions. But what I want to say is I think what was the most powerful thing for me in the whole situation was that I was determined to be curious and not defensive. My first reaction was defensive. I had a whole case for why I let her go, why I was not a misogynist. I had it all worked out. And then the moment I got on the call, I dropped it. No agenda. I tried to connect with her as a human being. I loved John Powell's video, if you haven't had a chance to watch it. The more we humanize people, the less likely we are to just defend a position, but actually make a genuine connection with a person. I was curious about her and what did she really mean? I tried not to make assumptions about what it meant to be a misogynist. So I said, what does that mean to you? What did I do that? So instead of making a lot of assumptions, I asked a lot of questions. And I was really, I think, willing to own my piece of the harm. And there were pieces that were mine, absolutely. And I had taken time to really think about that. So in the end, I'll cut to the chase. We had an actually amazing conversation, which personally was really healing for me. I think especially when we think of ourselves as good people, which I would imagine everyone on this video thinks of themselves as a good person, to have somebody poke at that is actually a gift, because it allows you to actually become a good person by being willing to hear about somebody else's truth and then to own your own truth in the circumstance. But through those two truths, to make a genuine, human, heartfelt connection rather than two basically talking heads trying to defend their positions, which ends up being nothing good comes of that. There's no movement. There's no learning. There's no humanity to it. It's just people lobbing words at each other. And so I think our own willingness to be vulnerable and our real honest desire to make a real connection with another human being actually can shift things. But screaming at each other on Facebook or not actually making, really being willing to hang in the fire with someone else, we won't get anywhere. And it's kind of why war happens now. Why there's so much hatred and war is because we actually don't want to connect. But I think if we connect, there's something different that can happen. So suffice to say, we actually had plans to meet up with each other in person. We don't live in the same city, but things can happen.
Thank you so much, Jane. Thank you very much for that very personal story. And also some of the key big lessons for you. Jody, I want to invite you to share a little bit now.
I didn't quite catch, did you say?
I'm inviting you to share now.
Okay. So my name is Jody Fried. I'm the executive director at Catamount Arts in St. Johnsbury, Vermont, and also VLI graduate. And I spend, like Jane, a very significant portion of my time in the different roles that I hold in the community, dealing with difficult conversations. And I would say in the past 18 months, specifically here in the Northeast Kingdom where I reside, that things have gotten much more intense, and the environment that we're having those conversations has changed fairly dramatically. And not for the better, I would say. That it has, while there, I think, are more people speaking up, which is a good thing, I think the polarization and the overall intensity tends to be closing down and isolating people, not allowing people to connect more. And so as I've approached things, and I hold a number of different roles within the community on different boards, different organizations. I have four kids, so this comes up all the time in the household itself. And then, as I was thinking of the example to use, I also thought of examples related to my health, because I went through, within the last 3 years, went through a really significant bout with cancer that was really serious. I'm in good position now, but when we were going through that as a family and making decisions, we were having very difficult conversations about pathways and what kind of treatment and how were we going to move forward as a family and the what ifs. So thinking through all of those, I decided for today to talk to you a little bit about a conversation that I recently had with a good friend and related to the gun debate. And here in the Northeast Kingdom, we have a very strong dichotomy, I would say, of people who are native to the Northeast Kingdom, multi-generational, have lived here forever, and guns are really a part of their culture. The hunting camp closing down businesses for multiple weeks, bringing hunting rifles to high school when we were kids. This was and still is part of the culture here. And then you have another culture that really, I think, started in the late 60s, early 70s, and there were a lot of transplants that came up here, much more liberal, and now there's another generation that is spun off from those folks. And everybody coexists, and everybody coexists very well here in the Northeast Kingdom. There's a fierce sense of independence. But this gun debate has been a real point of emotion and intensity here. And having grown up in the Northeast Kingdom, I'm a native here, born and raised, and having grown up around both sets of people and also both sets of the culture, when it specifically came to the gun debate, I hunted all through my, most of my childhood and adult life. I have been around guns, have been at hunting camp, and yet the majority of the people in my own family and in my closest circle of friends are very much, I would say, not gun-oriented. I wouldn't say anti-gun, but and so I find myself in a really interesting position as these conversations unfold, having these discussions with different folks. And I guess I don't know that I've quite figured it all out. I would just, I'll throw some of my experience at you, which is that, one, I think at the heart of it, when I speak to my friends on both sides of this debate, these are folks that I've known in some cases, you know, for 40 plus years, and have very intimate relationships with, I think at heart, everybody feels the same way. I think that the core values there, and if you can get to that part of the conversation, both sides of the issue feel the same. They want to protect their families. They want to protect their children. They want to have safe schools. They want to have safe communities. They want to protect the rights that they feel are important to them. You can go through the list, but I think those core values exist. And so as you're having the conversations, and I know as I have been trying to focus in around those core values and figure out where those kind of roads meet, and they don't always meet, and then having the strength to be able to listen and still respect and love somebody who has a different opinion from you, knowing that you might not get to a point of compromise or resolution, but I think there is a lot to be gained in those conversations of better understanding each other and understanding why perhaps you disagree and where you disagree, so that the next conversation can be more fruitful and you have places to build upon. And then when you sit down in a community meeting and you have the same goals and you've gotten to know each other and kind of know what's important to each other, and you start to look for solutions, you can start finding pathways to that. And so, you know, a recent conversation that I had, it started out fairly heated, and it ended up being once the conversation turned to our kids, interestingly, which I think is often the case, and the safety of our children, we got to a point where we were bouncing ideas off each other, where we were actually, you know, testing the waters. Would this be okay? Would this be okay? And a lot of them, I would say the majority of them weren't okay with either of us, but we were slowly kind of finding our way through that in a place of mutual respect and love. That conversation ended up, I think, in a very interesting place, which was that we had both given, we had both listened. Neither of us really, I would say, ended up where we started, which I think is an interesting way of looking at it. Not about winning or losing. It's kind of about that journey along and heading in a path that's right. And if you go into it about winning and losing, boy, you're in for a tough road in this world. But we ended up at a place where I think we were, we had made enough progress that we both left that conversation. And when we re-engaged several days later, the conversation, it felt like we were light years ahead. And we've built upon that even further. So, I don't know if that's helpful, but I think the, you know, some things that I would take out of that are this idea of really going in open-minded, really going in willing to listen. And I think, if I have one, one bit of advice in all of these conversations and what I've learned about myself in the last 18 months is to bite my tongue. To slow my head down and to really listen and listen at a whole different level, and not just listen on the periphery, but listen and try and dissect and figure out where people are coming from and what are those core values, because I think that's where you're going to meet people. A couple other things, just observations from these difficult conversations, and this holds true more than just with the that specific example I was referring to, but I've found that social media is a disaster for these conversations. And I think that, social media is perhaps a way to observe and figure out who you should be having conversations with or who you want to But I would encourage you to quickly move away from that. And I even think email in this day and age, I think anything that depersonalizes the communication, you're really losing a lot. And so while it's difficult to have difficult conversations in person, it's much harder than, being able to sit in the safety of your virtual world. I think that's the place that solutions are found. And so picking up the phone, calling somebody is a start. And, as Jane said, meeting with them, if you need to have a third person, have a third person, but that face-to-face meeting can't be replaced. And it is, people are so much more genuine and so much more respectful, and you have such better, more productive conversations that, that you can then build on, because rather than conversations that just kind of end and don't go anywhere. And then finally, I recently had a friend, a longtime friend, who I guess you would say unfriendly, and I'm not talking about Facebook, but their views were to the point where they felt strongly enough, and that I wasn't in that far of a corner with them, that ending a 40-year relationship was where they were at. And I have to tell you, it's the first time that's ever happened to me in my life. It was within the last 2 weeks. My wife said, somebody just died. I mean, that was her comment to me. You're going through mourning. I mean, I was extremely sad for 2 days. I responded to the person and said, I'm here if you ever want to talk. But essentially, I lost a person to this world that we're living in. And it was really, really difficult. So, there is a real cost, I think, that can, in this world, that we need to be aware of. And perhaps gaining skills around that is just as important. Because I know that was a learning experience for me. Again, I've never had somebody truly just unfriend me and leave me. Maybe I'm fortunate that way. But I've had plenty of people die in my life, but I've never had a friendship like that just die in a moment's notice. So I guess that's all I've got. That's had to share with you.
So thank you, Jody and Jane. I'm hearing, maybe I'll just take 10 or 20 seconds to say the common themes that I heard from your amazing stories and your very genuine sharing, which felt really potent to me. The common themes I'm hearing is approaching difficult conversations from the ground of curiosity, that there's a ground of care going beyond our own agenda, right or wrong, win or lose. Willing to deeply listen beyond what our usual capacity for listening is. Connect with core values, wherever that is. And then it's about this kind of coming together with difficult conversations is a journey versus some end point. And that in both what Jody and Jane shared was what struck me, I think, the most was a very genuine, heartfelt human connection. So with that, I want to take the last half hour and open this conversation up to the larger group and just be aware that we have a wonderful group, a lot of people. So when you're sharing your questions, comments, be as concise as you can and to allow as many voices as possible in the room. And also know that I have, if you weren't already muted, I have muted you. So you can find your unmute button on your screen at the top. So with that, I'm happy to open up the conversation to whoever would like to speak.
I'll ask a question.
Yeah, please.
So I find that, at least in my experience, people have been nervous or avoidant of these kinds of conversations. And so I'm curious about what both of your recommendations would be in terms of overcoming that kind of trepidation or fear and initiating a conversation that might be difficult.
I'll jump in. I think a neutral topic and a neutral setting. I'm a big, Jane's going to love this, Catamount Arts. The arts are extremely neutral. And so as you find an opportunity with somebody, finding a safe, neutral place to have a conversation, art centers are great for that. But a place where everybody feels safe and maybe it's the initial meeting isn't even about the topic that you want to have. Maybe it's food is always a good thing, going and having lunch with somebody so there's food involved. If it's a really difficult conversation, maybe asking to meet at a cafe over coffee where there's a good buzz. I think the environment does have a lot to say. And music playing. It sounds simple, but it neutralizes and takes some of the edge off of those conversations. Just some basic advice that I've found from having difficult conversations: make sure that you're looking eye to eye. If you're in a room and there's any, I'm a big person, and if all of a sudden I'm towering over somebody, it changes the dynamics of the conversation. So slouch down and get eye to eye and find a way that I'm able to physically be at the same point and meet somebody in a truly neutral space. So those are some of my thoughts. The arts are great for this.
I told Jade he's shameless in promoting our very special location in the Northeast Kingdom, which I love. Yeah, I think I totally resonate with what Jody's saying. And I learned something recently from a wonderful Zen teacher, Reverend Angel Kyoto Williams. And she was talking about assess what kind of relationship you want with this person. And that determines a lot about how patient you can be. If you want a long-term relationship with this person, if they're important in your life, like they're a family member or somebody you expect to work with for a very long time, then you can afford to be patient and you can do things like, start with neutral topics, neutral places, and all of that, just making a genuine human connection with that person because it's important. We have to invest time in relationships. We're not machines, so we can't like have a formula and go in with our agenda and make it happen. So if you don't have that time or you don't really want to invest in that relationship, then recognize that you may not have the outcome that you really want because you have to do it so quickly, or it's a work relationship and something hinges on it, in which case create as much of a kind opening situation as you possibly can to have to go in there really quickly. It's almost like the more quickly you have to do it, the more vulnerable you need to be if you want it to be successful. If you have patience, then you can amp up the vulnerability on a slower burn than a quicker burn, depending on what you're seeking from the relationship.
Thank you, Jane.
I could contribute something. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. What I've been reflecting on is some of the insights that Jane and Joe are sharing and bringing that into the structures that we often work in and how and then trying to find your person within that. So it's one thing for me to think about how I may handle within a personal relationship outside of that, this kind of challenge. But it's another thing to then find the pressures and trying to determine, you know, what's too personal or what's not too personal when you're watching the conflict happen in the context of multiple stakeholders and structures that you're working in. I don't know exactly that I've had come to a specific conclusion. I have reached out to nonviolent communication as a way to try to kind of understand the conversations that we're not having in the at the systems level about what is kind of raw and doesn't have a silver bullet answer that we're that we as adults are contending with in our work world. So anyway, that's just some thoughts on that have for to share.
Thank you, John.
This is Amy Mason. Can you hear me?
Yes.
So I've been thinking a lot about the themes of curiosity and slowing down, which is hard for me because I am someone who really values efficiency in getting things done. But I think there's a trade-off there, and I've learned that. I've been in the role of board chair for Women Safe here in Addison County for a couple of years, and we had challenging decision that we had to make about one of the policies we wanted to change, and we were pretty split on it. And I think I was eager to move us through toward, you know, onto other tasks. And early on, I thought that if we could just, you know, come around to the side that the new thinkers were on, that we would, you know, be able to move forward. Well, it turned out that really listening to the opposition, I hate that word, but you know, the folks with the other ideas ended up serving us better in the long run. And it took longer, but the ultimate place that we landed was more informed than if everything had just gone more quickly to begin with. So I'm trying to learn to look for those opportunities to slow down and listen to people who have ideas that seem really counter to my own to begin with, because often it actually puts you in a better place than you thought you'd be if you hadn't. So.
That's so great, Amy. I really appreciate what I've learned is if I don't do that, I actually end up spending more time because I have to clean up all the little messes that have occurred because I moved too quickly or I didn't thoroughly bring everybody along. And so we've got stragglers who are like drag factors on change. You know, if you don't bring your stragglers along that you have to bring along, you don't always have to bring everybody along, but you end up with a lot of drag on the change, actually spending a lot of time trying to work with the people who don't feel they were brought along to begin with. So it's short-term, long-term kind of thinking, and long-term thinking often is way more efficient than short-term.
This is Susanna Weller. I work at the Essex Community Justice Center. Thank you for both of you sharing your stories. One thing I noticed, Jane, in your story is that it started with a clear power differential. You had the power to kick someone out, to ask them to go. And it's not every person in power who's willing to go back and listen and be called out. And I'm wondering if there is are any thoughts about how to engage across power structures on these talks, especially when someone in a structurally lower place wants to call out someone in a structurally higher place who might not be Jane and might not be as curious and interested?
I have thoughts, but if there's somebody else who wants to speak, speaking of power, I don't want to hold the power here because I'm one of the people who is put in this spot. Is there anybody else? We're kind of dealing with this right now, I would say, Susanna, in the work I do. where not everybody is willing. So what I'll just say is you have to create structures that even the power out, you know, whether it's some kind of reporting that has to occur outside. So you set up, you know, I don't like this word grievance procedures, or you have to have some way that somebody's voice can get heard and get worked with in a healthy way, and that leadership can receive that feedback. You have to create a separate structure, has been my experience. If you don't have a leader, I'm sad. If we don't have leaders that are willing to take the feedback, then it's not, I hate to even say this so bluntly, but it's not leadership, frankly. If somebody isn't willing to take the feedback as a leader, it's certainly not how VLI taught me to take feedback for sure. I don't know if that's what you're getting at, Susanna, but that's one way around it.
This is Jody. I know in our organization that we have a annual review process, which for myself, every one of the staff members in the organization submit a review of me. And that goes directly to our board of directors to review. And it's a very reflective process when you start to, the first time was very reflective in just the process itself, but then figuring out how you communicate. I had one of my first bosses in my professional life. His advice to me was that if you ever have to fire somebody, it should never come as a surprise to them. And I've always thought of that of myself. If I ever get fired or there's ever a problem, it shouldn't come as a surprise. So as I thought about that that review process, you know, it forced me to open up channels of communication that were different with my employees and with our staff and with our team that perhaps hadn't existed before, and certainly for myself weren't there, or I wasn't listening. That may have been the case. So that's been one way. And then just back to John's comment, I've been sitting here thinking about his observation and the work that Paul Costello does with the Vermont Council on Rural Development, and really digging into the really the kind of the grassroots democracy of decision making. I think about that all the time in terms of organizations I'm in, but whether it's at Catamount or it's our community organizations, and how can we have that same democratization within our individual structure so that ideas and the commonality that arises and bubbles from below and from bubbles up into solutions. And I wonder if there's, you know, as you have different situations occur within, whether at workplace or other organizations or other power structures, that if returning to those fundamental principles of being able to allow people to voice their opinions in safe places, everybody listening, and then really being future focused and trying to move forward towards common goals. And boy, Paul's an expert at that. I've learned so much watching him over the years. So just some thoughts.
Thank you for your questions, Susanna, and your comments, John. Susanna, did we get it? Was that helpful? Did you want to take your question a little bit further?
I feel like mostly got at it. Some of the structures that I have the opportunity to deal with are structures where the person who needs to confront someone is under the age of 18 and they're confronting an adult. And so there are both sometimes within a school system, and so there are both structural hierarchies as well as cultural hierarchies in that. And so that's just something that I'm thinking through right now. Yeah. And I think that the structural piece is one piece, and the cultural piece and kind of adults believing that they can learn from young people is another one that I'm thinking through.
Just to chime in real quickly, one thing that we've always had is we've always had a student representative in our leadership team. So it's a member of our board, and it's a peer to other students. It allows them to have somebody to approach, but by creating that peer and creating that voice formally within the organization, it gives it weight and gives it importance.
Thank you all.
Hi, my name is Daniel, and I'm a critical friend of the Bay and Paul Foundations and spend a week a month in Vermont, working both in Burlington with the school district and statewide at Vermont Learning for the Future and Up for Learning and various other organizations. I'd like to build on the notion of being curious rather than certain. I've thought when we're certain on a position that certainty is actually intellectual suicide. Once you're certain of something, there's no room for growth. So in entering into a difficult conversation, I like to share that notion that I'm not coming with a sense of certainty of my position, and that I'm also not looking for us to be the same. The valuing of difference is really critical. And to share with the person I'm going to be working with or a group that the goal of our conversation isn't to end up in the same place. It's really to have a much better understanding of each other's positions so that we can grow, find common ground so that we can relate and be fully human with each other rather than judging. There's an agreement that I think really, really helps in entering those conversations. And we've talked about deep listening. Some people call it empathic listening. But when we listen for understanding, and when listening for understanding, we must withhold judgment while we're listening. We're not preparing how we're going to retort. We don't stop listening and thinking about what we're going to say next. And sharing that thought with the person I'm going to have a conversation with, I find it really, really helpful because they know I'm going to be fully present while they're speaking, and I'm just asking them to try to do the same.
This is Helen Reilly, and I have a question in terms of the utilization of retreats for small boards. I serve on the city council in South Burlington, and we have some challenges, I think, among some of the members and with our city manager. And the suggestion was made to have a retreat to really discuss those or understand them. And a lot of what has been said today is really helping me sort of frame that. I chair the city council, so I guess it's kind of my obligation to organize this thing. But I was just curious if anyone has some thoughts about how helpful that is, or if there are other ways to have those important conversations.
I'll chime in regarding the retreats. We have an annual retreat every year for our organization, for our leadership team. And over the decade that I've been participating in those here at Catamount, we've been slowly moving away from them being very focused around issues and much more around gaining personal relationships. And so we've gone to, we do potlucks, we have team building exercises, we have lots of time for just talking. And then if we do have the more structured, it tends to be more around values and shared values, and less around trying to solve the specific issue. We let that carry through and take that out of the meeting. And hopefully then your next board meeting or your council meeting, everybody is coming in there with a different understanding of each other. And so I, to me, that's the biggest strength of those from my personal experience.
Yeah, I just want to echo that. I think relationship. They're really that's what it is to work together. And you can go at issues and actually damage your relationship such that you won't ever recover. And if you have good, strong relationships, then you can weather a lot of things together. There's a lot of trust. We haven't talked about trust yet, but that's a huge piece of being able to go deep into a difficult conversation is the ability to really trust. And that just gets built with time and relationships. So I echo what Jody's saying, that just enjoying each other's company and getting to know about each other's families and what you care about, what matters to you. It's, again, it sounds like a waste of time, but honestly, it's gotten me through a lot of things, is that I actually have a relationship with people. And and don't do it by yourself, Helen. I not that you would, but if you decide to go into these difficult things, do enlist some help to create a little space so that you have somebody who's holding the complexity of those relationships. Definitely not to be done alone if you decide you're going to do that in some context. But yeah, retreat should be for nourishment and enjoying each other and creating common bonds. That's how I think the best use of retreat is, like Jody. And Daniel, I really appreciate what you're saying. And I wanted to say one thing more. There's actually one more step of listening, which is actually listening someone into their own wisdom, which is like the next transcendent kind of listening, which is super amazing when that can happen. You're listening so, and you're so connected to that person that they actually get to find their own way completely on their own.
We have about 10 more minutes, 8 or 10 more minutes. So I invite the conversation to go where it needs to go.
This is Holly from Whole Heart, and I'd just like to follow up on that theme of the listening into deeper speech. A lot of the work we do with intergenerational leadership and circles of trust is based on Parker Palmer's work. And the ability to, I think there's that also option or invitation to bring, come from the side, like not necessarily, I think there's that direct efficiency, but there's also there's some blessings of coming in from the side of like using some poetry or using something that isn't necessarily that direct, you know, the efficient way in, but offers a way of expanding our listening abilities. I think, you know, that's what the most simple thing is a poem. You know, you can't rush a poem and you can't, there's some spaciousness and it often is a little bit different. It's a different language. And I think that's also the piece of like, making a point, it's kind of our, there's this pathway written into our beings of like, here's what I'm gonna make, here's what I know. So I really appreciate that letting go of the certainty. And we need lessons on listening. It's not easy. And so I think that the thoughts of retreats around both getting to know one another, but also having an opportunity to listen in a different way can then open something greater for getting back to task. And it's not off task, but it's a different, it invites a different pattern. So just wanted to add that.
Thank you, Holly.
On our team, one of the things we regularly talk about is ambiguity tolerance and making sure that we all know where other team members fall on that spectrum and trying to respect but also grow with that. It's amazing once you start putting language around that and having discussions around it, how much your team grow. And so, and that's just one of the things we do within the Catamount staff, but if you do that in other organizations too, is in uncertain times, everybody recognizing that uncertainty and where their comfort levels are And talking about it allows the other people to understand where they're coming from, because it gives you some measurement of risk or, anyway, I that came to mind with your comment. I thought I would.
Yeah, maybe I'll just put a little another cherry on that, on Jody's top there. It's like we also have to be comfortable with resolution. Some things are not resolvable. I think we have a kind of feeling like everything should be, but not all things are resolvable, nor should they be, actually.
I'm very involved with interracial discourse and dialogue, and one of the real issues in that make those conversations so difficult is the notion of white fragility, and we often don't speak of that in terms of how defensive white people can be when race is raised as an issue. And to name white fragility and talk about it prior to going into the conversation, and contrast it with the reality of life in America as a black person, and how tough and hard they have to be in order to survive, and to contrast that with the difficulty of having a conversation. And to have an open dialogue about that tension between the fragility and the difficulty prior to getting into the discourse is, I found that to be really, really helpful to help people to lower their defense.
Thank you, Daniel. I'm aware of the time, and I want to let people know what's next before folks have to go off to their next meeting or next conversation, as it were, whatever is happening next. First, a huge thank you to Jane Arthur and Jody Fried for their fully showing up, for your stories, your best practices. Thank you so much. Secondly, thank you to everyone who showed up in the conversation, whether you spoke or not. Having your face or your name on the screen, it meant a lot for the conversation to go where it went. We have Chewing on Leadership every other month or so, and I'll be sending out information about that. If you are interested, if you are not a Snelling Center graduate from one of our programs and would be interested in having more of these conversations, the Vermont Leadership Institute is accepting applications. If you are a VLI grad and know someone who would enjoy these kinds of conversations and more, send them to our website or nominate them on our website, and we'll get in contact with them. I have made a recording for some other people who couldn't join, so I'll send that out with some resources from our conversation today. Thank you again for your time and your generosity. Have a good rest of your day. Thank you, Tamika, for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
It's great to see so many VLIers. Thanks, Jody and Suzanne.
So good to see you again.
Yeah, bye.
Thank you, Suzanne.
And you're welcome. Bye, everyone. I'm so glad you came.
Yeah. So I didn't.
Thank you very much, Suzanne.
You're welcome, Rob.
I think this was an excellent exercise, and a lot of participation and a lot of listening, too.
Yeah, so, very special.
Yeah.
Good to have you here, Rob.
Thank you, Daniel. Good day.
You pleasure. Too. And do you work in the Burlington area?
I work in Colchester.
Yes.
At the studio.
At the studio, mm-hmm. Of course.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So I'm trying to kind of be out more
in the community meeting with our donors and things. But yeah, I work out of Colchester, but I live in the south end of Burlington.
Success. Hi,
this is Mark Snelling.
Hi.
Nice to meet you, Mark.
Nice to meet you.
Nika Davis.
Nice to meet you.